My name is George Cairns.
And I'm Nancy Cairns.
And we've kind of divvied this up, so mostly I'm going to talk today, and mostly Nancy's going to talk tomorrow, and we'll add bits and pieces. And our hope is that we'll talk for about half an hour and then have a chance for us to engage in conversation. I'd like to say, first of all, how pleased and we are to have been invited to be here. It's a delight to be here, and we feel very humble to be in a place like this that is so dedicated to the principles that we hold so dear. What we're going to offer is a very personalized kind of view. Nancy and I both call ourselves contemplative activists, and so in some ways our message is very simple, but it's also very difficult in that what we talk about is acting first and then trying to find words for experience. Our liberation theology friends call this praxis. So it means that we really deeply engage in the world and then we reflect on our experience. And part of this is that our ideas are always tentative. And so Nancy and I lived up in northern Minnesota in a very pristine wilderness area for a number of years, and now we live in one of the most damaged environments that I can imagine, the inner city of Chicago. And what we're attempting to do is to put together our understandings of systems of oppression and systems of joy and creation that are in both of those kinds of places and every other place too. A simple definition of deep ecology is that it's a path of personal growth and transformation for us as individuals and for systems of human and other biological systems. It works by fully involving ourselves in deeper relationship with all beings. And the key words here, it involves our deeply involving ourselves in relationship with. And for those of you who know contemplatives and have read Merton's work or some of the other contemplatives' work, one of the real senses that comes out of contemplative prayer is a sense of belonging to all of creation, not standing outside of it, but being within it. And in some ways, what we're talking about is as this process continues and deepens, it must involve a metanoia, an opening of the heart to all of creation. And I mean, we know that's, you know, that's certainly it's the heart of the Gospels, but it's also something that we think is extraordinarily difficult for us to do. Nancy and I are both trained as psychologists, and we're aware of how easy it is to shut down and how easy it is to alienate ourselves from relationship, both human relationship and relationship with the rest of creation. And so the folks in the deep ecology movement originally drew a distinction between what they call shallow environmentalism and deep ecology. And again, this is very much oversimplified and we can elaborate this in our discussion, but shallow environmentalism in some ways, I think the critical piece is it involves us standing outside of creation. And in many ways, much of the view of Christian stewardship has kind of been that way, where we stand outside of and manage creation rather than seeing ourselves as deeply interpenetrating with it. And as the week goes on, we'll talk about gifts that people from other traditions, as well as the cloud of witnesses in the Christian tradition, have to offer us, particularly people in the Native American tradition who have been our teachers, as well as some teachers, some Buddhist teachers who are very much involved in the worldwide environmental movement. Also, I think one of the great contributions we should mention is the contribution of feminist theology. And at this point, I want to apologize for not having the books here that we had ordered. Everyone assured us back at our bookstore in Chicago that they were available, but we highly recommend the books that are on the board here. The two we ordered for this class, one was by Paulos Marcos Gregorios, he's a metropolitan of the Syrian Orthodox Church and a president of the World Council of Churches. And he wrote a book from the Eastern Orthodox perspective looking at ecological spirituality in the age of spirit, and really captures in a very elegant way, for those of you who are theologians, who are theologically inclined, the real presence of God in all of creation, as well as the transcendence of God. The other book that we ordered, which just came out this year, which now is not available this temporarily, is called Spirit and Nature. It's edited by Stephen Rockefeller and John Elder in it. And the subtitle is Why the Environment is a Religious Issue. It's a wonderful series of talks given by people, including the Dalai Lama, Sally McFaig, who's a wonderful feminist theologian, people from the Islamic and Jewish traditions. So it's some really good resources that I really we hardly recommend to you. So in the 70s, there was this development of this distinction between being set aside from or being embedded in. And at some point later in the week, we can talk more about this whole notion of deep ecology. The classic text one of the classic texts is Deep Ecology by Duvall and Sessions, that really explores the ideas of, I can never quite pronounce this guy's name, Arjen Maas. Some of you may know his work very well. So that's another source for those of you who want to go back and look at some other things. But there was this kind of, I think the major theme here is this theme of seeing ourselves being deeply embedded in and opening ourselves to all of creation. And I don't want to oversimplify the difficulty of this task. It's extraordinarily difficult to continually open our heart to both the pain of creation and the joy of creation. And there's in our culture, really, Nancy will talk in more detail tomorrow, is really Western culture over the last probably 10,000 years has slowly evolved in ways that have alienated us from nature, being embedded in nature. And so part of our task is to undo in some ways this 10,000 years of cultural distancing from being in the world. What I'd like to do is to share a few scriptural passages that capture some of the sense that we think is embodied in this movement in deep ecology. The first passage is from Psalm 104, and I'll read from verses 24 and 25. And again, this is to point out the real presence of God in all of creation. It says, "Lord, you have made so many things. How wisely you made them all! The earth is filled with your creatures. There is the ocean, large and wide, where countless creatures live, large and small alike." And now looking at verses 27 and through 30. "All of them depend on you to give them food when they need it. You give it to them, and they eat it. You provide food, and they are satisfied. When you turn away, they are afraid. When you take away your breath, they die and go back to dust from which they came. But when you gave them breath, they are created. You give new life to the earth." And then looking at Romans 8, verses 18 through 25, I think this shows the kind of continuous process. "I consider that what we suffer at this present time cannot be compared at all with the glory that is going to be revealed to us. All of creation waits with eager longing for God to reveal God's sons and daughters. For creation was condemned to lose its purpose, not of its own will, but because God willed it to be so. Yet there was the hope that creation itself would one day be set free from its slavery to decay and would share the glorious freedom of the children of God. For we know that up to the present time, all of creation groans with the pain, like the pain of childbirth. But it is not just creation alone which groans. We who have the Spirit as the first of God's gifts also groan within ourselves as we wait for God to make us God's sons and daughters and set our whole being free. For it was by hope that we were saved. But if we see what we hope for, then it is not really hope. For who hopes for something that person sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. In the same way, the Spirit also comes to help us, weak as we are. For we do not know how we ought to pray. The Spirit itself pleads with God for us in groans that words cannot express. And God, who sees in our hearts, knows what the thought of the Spirit is, because the Spirit pleads with God on behalf of God's people and in accordance with God's will. We know that in all things God works for good with those who love God, those whom God has called according to God's purpose. Those whom God has already chosen, God has also set apart to become like God's Son, so that the Son would be the first among many brothers and sisters. And so those whom God set apart, God called. And those God called, God put right with God's self, and God shared God's glory with them." So we're seeing some scriptural senses of the real presence and movement of God and the Spirit in history. And I'd like to just read one more passage here, which is a very, this is not good historical critical reading, okay? But from 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And this is one of my favorite passages, and it's one that we're very familiar with, beginning with verse 12. And what I'd like to do is to urge us to consider, as our Buddhist friends do, when the Buddhists talk about the Sangha, or the community of faith, they use it in several ways. First of all, they talk about the community of believers, but they also use that word to indicate, ultimately, the community of all creation. Right? And so, while this is clear that this passage is written to the house churches in Corinth, think about this text being looked at in terms of the community of all creation. And just hear these words in a slightly different way and see if they resonate. It says, Christ is like a single body which has many parts. It is still one body, even though it is made up of different parts. In the same way, all of us, whether Jews or Gentiles, whether slaves or free, have been baptized into the one body by the same Spirit, and we have all been given the one Spirit to drink. For the body itself is not made up of only one part, but of many parts. If the foot were to say, because I am not a hand, I don't belong to the body, that would not keep it from being a part of the body. And if the ear were to say, because I am not an eye, I don't belong to the body, that would not keep it from being a part of the body. If the whole body were just an eye, how could it hear? And if it were only an ear, how could it smell? As it is, however, God put every different part in the body, just as God wanted it to be. There would not be a body if it were all only one part. As it is, there are many parts, but one body. So it's an interesting rehearing of that, I think, even though, again, it's not good historical critical reading. I think the sharing and the Eucharist last night expressed the Paschal mystery, and the sharing of the Eucharist is a celebration of all creation. And it's a breaking into everyday time of the spirit of all creation, and showing the interpenetration and the falling away of history in many ways. And again, part of the opening that, and we'll talk more about this as the week goes on, of a contemplative notion, is that we're not really separate from one another. But this isn't a head trip. Okay, we're putting words around this today to try to express experience that we very profoundly have with one another and with all of creation. But it's a lived way of being. And deep ecology, in our sense, is a way of being. It's a way of deeply being with all of creation. And creation responds. We were talking about prayer last night. We've been places where creation responds to us in very profound and mysterious ways. We'll talk about some of that. And our sisters and brothers in the Native American tradition know this so much better than we do, because our culture has pulled us further and further away from that. But I've been to the pipe ceremonies where the eagles come. And it's very difficult as a rational scientist to realize that when the elder of the Native American elder says, if God accepts what we do here today in celebration, an eagle will come. And the eagle comes. It's very powerful, my friends. It's very mysterious, and it's very wonderful. I would think that what we're going to do this week is to look at ways of opening our heart to creation. And we're also going to try to build bridges between some of the new scientific worldview and contemplative theology, not, I hope, with $10 words, but in kind of experienced kind of words, to talk about the way that the new views of systems, the way systems interpenetrate in our world, are in sympathy with the experiences of contemplatives like Hildegard and Meister Eckhart, and people, contemporary folks like Thomas Merton. So, and what we'll be doing is exploring how difficult this process is. It's easy for us to say we wish to open our heart to all of creation. It's extraordinarily difficult to do. I think the practice of a place like Holden is a practice of opening the heart. So you know, as we watch our water use, as we recycle everything as best we can, it's a praxis that helps us to open our heart. But in many ways, the opening of it's the praxis itself. It's not labeling that as shoulds, but it's the fact that our engaging in these kind of practices themselves really result in a kind of opening that otherwise couldn't be there. And so for many of us in the Protestant tradition, I hang out with lots of Catholic folks too. Some people call me a closet Catholic, a Roman Catholic, but I find that people, the contemplatives in the Catholic tradition have much less use for words and much more use for experience and action. And so what I find is that if we work out of a praxis, out of a shared practice, then new insights can come that we can't get to from the words. We can find the words later, we can struggle to find it. And that's what Nancy and I are trying to do here this week. We're trying to build some bridges between living in northern Minnesota and looking at the ecology there and how to be open to creation there, and also to see creation in the city, to see the richness of that's offered and gifts in the city. Well, are there any questions that you have thus far? Are there any comments or thoughts?
I wanted to say a couple more things about this difference between standing outside of creation as opposed to standing as part of it. George mentioned that in some ways notions of Christian stewardship have been part of that, standing outside. And the way I think of it is that we tend to talk about parts of the environment, parts of nature, in terms of what they do for us. There's a group, I think it's nationwide, called Ducks Unlimited, that's very dedicated to conservation because they want more ducks to shoot. You know. Now, there's been some good effects of that. There are more ducks probably than there would be without Ducks Unlimited. But I think the point of view of deep ecology is different from that sort of human-centered point of view, in that from the point of view of deep ecology, the ducks should survive for the sake of the ducks. You know, the ducks are their own beings and have their own value. For me, some of the difficulty of really getting into this is that if you take it very far, you come to the point where the rats and the mice and the roaches and the moths and the Giardia, you know,
that's right,
all have their own value. And that's very tough. For me, the roaches are probably the toughest part of it. There's a part of my heart that's definitely closed to roaches. So I think that's a distinction that's crucial to me, and that is part of the difficulty of this way of being. The other thing I wanted to say is to sort of emphasize what I think are the contributions that the feminists have to make to this point of view, and to apologize. There are some very wonderful books on our list, and I'll be talking about a couple more tomorrow. But many of them are written in very sexist language. They're written by men. They're written about men. I suspect if you talk to most of the authors, they would say, well, we meant mankind. And somewhere in there, we think that includes you. I'm thinking of hiring out as an editor. So when I read some of our books, which I think are very helpful and have some very deep understandings, I am also translating in my head. And we do apologize for the necessity.
Picking up on your theme, it appears that there's a virtue in tending to ducks for the ducks' own sake, and there's lack of a virtue to the work of Ducks Unlimited, although the end may be favorable, but the means is short-sighted. Did I get you right there?
I wouldn't say lack of virtue, but I would say that what I'm thinking about when I'm thinking, when I'm trying to get my head into and my heart into being a part of this, is that the human motive is not necessarily the primary one or the most important one, and certainly it's not the only one.
I work out of both, you know, comfortably, and I struggle with thoughts like smallpox. Should we have 7 vials on the earth that are being maintained with the organisms, and this is always a fright that somebody's going to get one of these and use it as a threat. Do we burn up those last 7 vials and have it gone off the earth forever as a lost species? But with those few exceptions, I feel a need to be preserving. I struggle too with cockroaches and Giardia. But I see no difficulty in working as the Ducks Unlimited people do. We do it here at Holden. We have lawns and they're mowed and tended, and we're multiplying these grass plants for our own benefit, solely so that we can lie on them and walk on them and keep the dust down for our comfort, not in any way for the grass. And you know, with many, many things, and the plantings, the flowers, and encouraging certain creatures to be around. We may encourage certain birds to come that lead insects, and solely for our benefit, so we won't have any bugs biting us. I guess my bottom line is that I, and maybe others here too, work comfortably out of both sides. One, to protect the species, and the other is to have a stewardship over them for my benefit.
Yeah, there aren't easy answers here. I mean, I hope we don't sound like we're offering up answers. It seems to me that that we all have to make choices, and the choices, it seems to me, the kind of overgirding or underlying kind of place that we're working out of or trying to work out of is a sense of building deeper relationship with. And sometimes that means intervening in the natural process because of other things going on. Sometimes it means standing aside from it. There are many difficult choices, and people of goodwill will certainly come down in different places in that regard. Now, but what I would like to urge us to consider doing is, again, one of the problems with developing policy or positions and this kind of thing is part of the thing, is it can lead to hardening of the heart. And again, part of the contemplative view is to continue to be open to new possibility. And so while we need to have wise judgments about what makes sense in terms of policy over the long run, because we don't have a long vision in many ways for things, we're going to get into trouble. We also have to, I think, also be very open to possibility of new things coming about. And things are very dramatically interconnected. So things that we think we're doing so well sometimes will lead to deep trouble. And I, you know, like one of the things that comes to mind is I was on an environmental council in northern Minnesota, and they had scrubbers put in to cut down acid rain in this big, huge coal-fired plant. And it was wonderful. I mean, that they got rid of about 90% of the stuff coming out of these stacks. But unfortunately, as part of the process, they had these huge scrubbers, which produced these monstrous ash ponds with heavy metals, and so they were at the point where these ponds were full, and they wanted to discharge the water from these ponds into the Mississippi River, which and this we lived upstream from everybody there, which was a very interesting place to live. It provides with a particular kind of responsibilities we felt. But at times, a quarter of the flow of the Mississippi River would be coming from these ash ponds. And so here's an example of kind of this difficult kind of interconnection of things where in some ways an important kind of intervention, which was to cut back on this rain, would produce another kind of pollution that people were really struggling to deal with. So I think part of the message here is not to harden any position. Not to harden the position, because once we do that, we become alienated from other possibilities of creation. And for instance, I became a hunter again after not hunting for many years, after I met Native American people and realized there was and is a way to hunt, I think, ethically. And I know a lot of folks, you know, and we're pretty much vegetarian, but so it's very interesting kind of walking through that kind of path. with folks. And so I would urge all of us to kind of have this kind of openness of heart and to look at ways of developing that. And next week we're going to talk about a variety of methods that have come through the Christian tradition that are methods of continually opening ourselves. Now, the work of Gregory Bateson is very critical to our thinking. And Gregory Bateson was an anthropologist. Margaret Mead was his colleague and wife for a while. But he went through other stages in his life too, where he looked at the relationship of all creation in terms of patterning. And we're going to talk a lot about that as the week goes on. Not much today, but his arguments are that we engage in mind by certain kinds of relationship. And that this kind of existence as mind, is every bit as real, is every bit as much reality as what we think is going on inside of our cognitive skins. So really, when you walk the path of deep ecology, you're really talking about seeing through the eyes of the bear, thinking like a mountain. It's seeing ourselves as not being separate from. I mean, and it's very profound. It can be. It can be very scary, and it can be very joy-filled. Because again, the systems. If you open yourself to all that is, the world responds. God responds through the world. And so I think we need a kind of new theology. You know, traditional theologians talk about pantheism, about seeing God in all things. And then Matthew Fox, for some of you, talks about panentheism, where everything is in God. And I think we need more words for that, because I think that what some of the new science is talking about, and there's a wonderful conversation between Fritjof Capra, who's one of the new scientists, and David Stendahl Rast, who's a Trappist monk, called Belonging to All Creation. It's a wonderful book, where they talk about this kind of unfolding of God, of God's presence in so many different ways into creation, if we're able to open ourselves to that experience. So we're talking about some really radical stuff here, folks. I mean, it sounds simple, but it's very, very radical stuff. And of course, it leads to certain kinds of responsibilities then. Because with these understandings, it's like the ducks can't be managed for my purposes in some ways, because in some ways, I am the duck. I am the duck, folks. I mean, in some ways, and again, for those of you who are kind of Whiteheadian process theologians, you know, I mean, I'm not that much of a theologian, I'm kind of a budding theologian, but you know, it's like we're kind of a nexus, we're kind of a, I mean, the George is a being, a being that's unique in all of creation, but in some ways, I'm embedded in all of creation, and I have no separate kind of being from God's creation and how I got here. I mean, if you think that you came to this room because of us, you know, talking, I mean, that's not what. I mean, it's much more interpenetrating than that. In other words, we got here because of you. Like we all came here because of visions that folks had. And of Holden, and we're all part of the body of Christ, because there's a cloud of witnesses that throughout history has been a part of this mind. I mean, we say in some ways, in Batesonian terms, the church isn't so much the body of Christ, it's the mind of Christ. We're part of a being, an organic being, and the Eucharist is kind of a celebration of that. It's a reenactment, a restatement, and a celebration of the fact that we're all it, folks. It's a very, very rich kind of worldview. And again, like I said, we're in process of trying to figure out how to put words around this. Native peoples, primal peoples, have got lots of words for that. And so the places where Native Americans or Native African people or other folks who are kind of primal people who still have those close ties with the land are rubbing up against Christianity, some very interesting forms are developing. And we'd like to talk about some very interesting gifts are being given to one another. So, well, other thoughts that other, yes.
Maybe it's stating the obvious, but it seems that this is a process, not just today I'm not, today tomorrow I will be. That it's very much a process of growing into that kind of mindset, if you will.
Well, see, the contemplative view of the Paschal mystery, the contemplative view of salvation is it's a process. It's a constant unfolding. It's a constant death and rebirth. psychology, part of how I've been ruined is by experimental psychology. So for me, theology needs to make good sense in the way human beings function, the way I know they function, the way the 20th century world is. So if I can hear theology, it doesn't make sense to what I know about the way people function. I have a hard time with it. So that's a necessary condition, not sufficient, okay? It's a necessary condition that theology make good sense about how I know human beings live their lives and how they function. And I know the way that human beings function is minute by minute. And again, this is good Johannine theology, I think, is that we're either hardening our hearts or we're opening our hearts. We're either opening our ears so that we can hear and our eyes that we can see, or we're scaling them up, and that's constant. And
it's still a process. I think the first time I came to Holden and looked at what they do in ecology and recycling and food philosophy, and it was just totally overwhelming to say, how do I take this back and incorporate it? And the decision came, you do it one step at a time. You pick one thing that you're going to do this year or this month or whatever, however pace you can handle. But say you don't have to do it all today, or even this year. You have time, and there's a lifetime to work on it.
And if you look at the historical progression that we and some other folks think has happened, where we began our alienation from nature about 10,000 years ago, we have a lot of developing to do. Why would it happen overnight?
And then yet there's pockets that have reversed it quite rapidly.
Yeah, and there are pockets where the change hasn't even started. I mean, where the alienation hasn't started. But I think you're absolutely right. Any one person has to start right here.
Yeah.
And you can't start with everyone.
There are two basics, at least, I think we should keep in mind. Man was created in the image of God. That's not said about bears or whales or cockroaches. Another one, the Bible specifically gives instructions to man and Genesis to have dominion over the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. And that those instructions are not given to whales or beasts or cockroaches or anybody else.
Well, I guess, I don't disagree with what you're saying. But I think the issue of what it means to have dominion over is a very can be interpreted in many different ways, and I think a part again of the contemplative experience is an experience of being embedded in God's creation in such that how can I have dominion over myself? How can I have dominion over all of God's creation that I've enfolded and belong in? And so the view here too, I think, and again we'll talk about some of this next week. It's a view that's not a view of shoulds, as a view that's of have tos. Once you realize what the experience of being embedded in God's creation is, it's like you don't need rules to tell you have this. You realize from the experience of the presence of God in creation. That it follows that we must do this, and so I would certainly agree with what you're saying, but I would kind of turn the emphasis a little bit, maybe, at least from my perspective.
We are repeatedly admonished to be stewards, and stewardship entails responsibilities.
It certainly does.
But by the same token, Christ came to save mankind, the human race. He didn't come to save the whales or the bears or the cockroaches either.
Well, that's not what the New Testament says.
It seemed to me that depends on how you define dominion, because if you talk about God having a dominion over us, then you have to see how you interpret that, what that means. Is that relationship or is that control? And I think the essential difference is we've always defined dominion as being control versus being relationship, which is what Christ came to teach us God meant. Is it meant relationship, not control? So, I've often thought we misuse the concept of dominion by thinking of it in those terms, which is kind of our more distant kind of view of God, which I think has been transformed by the presence of Christ. So I think Christ really is what calls us to be in relationship versus being control. And that relationship does demand that we recognize that all of creation is God. That we are a part of that versus something outside of it that does something to it.
Well, I'm just going to say one thing to get by what you said. I think the Genesis account is clear that it's humans who are in the image of God, and that is not said of other creatures. But one thing that's really interesting in that account is that we share a day of creation with all the other animals. We think of ourselves as so separate sometimes in that story, but the fifth day is when fish and birds are created, and the sixth day is when all the animals are created, and we are among the animals on that day of creation. I had never really paid much attention to that, but I think that's a really important sense of relatedness, that we don't have our own day of creation separate from the animals. And I think Christ did come for the animals as well and for all creation.
Well, that's true, but he also breathes into man a living spirit, which he did not do into the animals. There's a profound difference between, we're mammals, but God breathed into man a living spirit. He didn't do that into the other mammals.
No, well, it sounds like what we're talking about is sort of the degree to which we're related, kin with all of the rest of creation, the degree to which we're separate, and we probably all believe both.
But we have a responsibility, there's no question about that. But I don't think there's an equality.
I appreciate particularly your emphasis on the term responsibility. And one of the things that clicked in me is you mentioned that a little further on in Genesis, where the whole business about God gave Noah the rainbow sign, where then, you know, the old account sort of underscores the covenantal relationship between Yahweh and humankind and all creation, which strikes me as a very dramatic way of both underscoring your comment about responsibility leading back to dominion, but also then your comment about relationship, that even in Genesis it's very clear that the view of relationship that's there, the covenantal view, is that we are in community with all of the orders of creation, and that is what has been ordained by that which has created the universe. So I was struck by that, and I appreciated your comment about responsibility, but I think that we do have to sort of push it through all of the, you know, the tremendous story of consciousness that's in even the book of Genesis.
I suppose what I think this gentleman's point is very well taken, which is I'm not seeing the biblical basis for deep ecology, and maybe I'm just being dense and not understanding your interpretation of the passage from Corinthians that you read, but it seems that we are told to take a stewardship view, and that this does definitely imply responsibility, and that in that sense, much of what we've been doing to the creation over the past 2,000 years or so is definitely a sin in the biblical sense. But a stewardship view is also anthropocentric and human-centered, which is something that, I mean, Sessions and Duvall in their 1985 book spent several chapters discussing how this stewardship view is wrong and is antithetical to a deep ecology viewpoint. And if you're going to take the point of view that we are equal with the bears and the ducks and the tiniest microbes in the soil, as Sessions and Duvall do in deep ecology, I suppose I'm a bit confused as to where, how this comes into a Christian perspective and where your biblical basis is for saying that, well, okay, you know, we're a human and therefore I am a duck. I understand that we are, you know, we're part of the creation and that's well and good. But I suppose I'm not getting the Christ name from the animals bit from the Bible. If someone could speak to that, maybe that's just something I've been missing all my life. But
well, I think the source that, I mean, theology has scriptural sources. It also has sources from tradition. And I may not be articulating this as well as I would like, but if you look at Franciscan spirituality, if you look at the spirituality of the contemplatives throughout the history of the church, the cloud of witnesses, their sense is not that we're the same as a duck, but the fact that we're so embedded in God's creation. And I would hope that the psalm that we read helped to suggest God's presence in all of creation and our connectedness with all of that creation. It's not that we're not separate from, it's not that we don't have special responsibilities, it's not that we aren't, again, each of us unique beings in God's creation, but rather it is a sense that's come through both Christ's contemplative experience as well as the contemplatives who followed Christ, that we are the separation, there's an eroding of the separation between us and the other. I think that's what we'd like to emphasize. And again, we maybe need to continue the discussion to look at other scriptural bases, but I think, you know, I think the what we're emphasizing, or what I've emphasized thus far, what we've thought about thus far, has to do with the cloud of witnesses and the contemplatives who've come down to us over the last 2,000 years. And again, the issue about what is the right of all beings? What are the rights of all beings? There's a very interesting book that we also have on our list here called Towards a Transpersonal Ecology. That's a very critical, along a lot of lines you're talking about the deep ecology movement. And we're closer, I think our thinking is more closely aligned towards this newer view, which looks at the unfolding of history. If you look at some of Teilhard de Chardin's work and some of the work of the Lure of the Future that comes through the work of the process theologians, it's not an equality of all being, but rather it is a way of looking from a human perspective and eroding some of these boundaries between us and all of God's creation and seeing our embeddedness in it. Now, where you come down exactly in terms of how anthropocentric you feel you should be, or what the necessity is, say, for greater good, the ethics about when do you sacrifice, when do you make sacrifices to have other beings be saved, is a profound kind of ethical debate. So I'm not sure I'm able to answer your question. And certainly the Corinthians chapter was a very atypical kind of interpretation, but one I would just urge us to kind of consider.
Yeah, it's a very interesting interpretation. It's a very interesting Buddhist interpretation. I'm just not certain that. I mean, you made a very good point, which is it's not good historical textual reading of what's going on in 1 Corinthians. And I think there might be some danger in taking this sort of interpretation when you have to do those kinds of things to the texts in order to get them to support your viewpoint that we are this deeply embedded in creation. I mean, there's no doubt that we're part of the creation, but to make any sort of equality and all interconnected and ignoring all of the Bible says about us receiving the Spirit of God and about Christ coming to save humans and possibly not to save Giardia is, I don't know, it just seems like we're playing a little fast and loose with the text of the Bible and also with what we consider source of Christian tradition.
I suspect there's a confusion on the word save, and I think generally when we speak of that as a church, it's saving one soul from destruction as opposed to saving a giardia cyst from being squashed. There's a big difference, and unfortunately we have words that have many meanings like love, and we really get stuck badly in using them. But I think we need to be careful here with the word save when we talk theologically and when we talk biologically.
Well, it seems like part of the whole problem with, you know, like we talk about Giardia and conferences, and a lot of what we've done is divide in our definition of what's good and what needs to be controlled and what isn't, and that part of that division has caused a lot of the chaos that we're dealing with. Now, sort of like your image of the plant and dealing with the acid rain, it's like you have to almost go backwards. I mean, at what point do we have to be more inclusive in terms of what we consider holy in creation? And you know, it's really tough. It's sort of like we're the disciples and we're listening to Christ talk about the reality of the world not being able to understand what it is. I think that the Bible and all of what God has given us to deal with is like you said, words and trying to understand truly what God's nature is and what God intends for this planet for us is a whole other story. And it's just real important not to oversimplify that in our understanding of what it means.
And I think also it's important not to underestimate the impact of our typical ways of thinking on what we read in the text. And again, this gets me back, among other things, to this definition of dominion. You know, we have dominion by virtue of our intelligence. We have dominion to the extent that we can create these enormous slag heaps around here. We can smash the atom. We can wipe out smallpox, except for 70 vials. how are we to use that? And is that dominion, is the ethics of that dominion the kind of ethic that is reflected by the word dominate? Or by the sense of power over? Or are we called to be, to have power with, to be in relationship with? And I'm not sure. We tend to think, as you said, in opposites, in dualisms, and we tend to think in hierarchies. And so difference, if two things are different, then one has to be better, or more powerful, or more valuable than the other. And I don't think that we're equal with the roaches and the giardia and the elephants and whatever. We're all unique.
It sounds like it's a semicolon, however, comma, and then you're going to say something else.
How did Victor Borga do period?
Well, I guess the however I would add, however, we're not as separate from one another as we
yeah.
usually think.
Yeah, we're unique and
as we usually feel and as we usually act. And I think that's the contribution, I think, of the contemplative tradition, is that we really are much more, you know, if Matt Fox were here, he would say, we've been in this room now for about 45 minutes, we're breathing each other's air, folks. Mm-hmm. So where do I stop and where do you begin? I mean, what is that? I mean, there's much less separation. We're good at separating one another. And that's part of our sin in some ways, I think. Part of our sin is our separation. Part of what I think happens is that part of what is the human being is to break things up. I mean, that's part of what we do to survive. It's important and it's good and it's necessary. But we also do it in places that cut us off from being in profound relationship. So we're kind of stressing. We're pushing the other side of it. Obviously, we're pushing the other side of it. And what I would urge, you keep pulling us back, and that's fine. But
Carol's been trying to say something about a year ago.
I was thinking of a very down home kind of example of what I think you're saying. Last summer, Holden came directly in contact with its relationship to wilderness when bears came into the village. And began to turn over garbage cans and seek out Holden food. And we had to recognize our interrelationship with wilderness, our interrelationship with bears, and our very big responsibility in the fact that if bears eat our food, the death knell of the bear is being tolled, because the bear will become a dependent critter and will die. Someone will have to kill that bear because it becomes too and encroaches too much upon humans. So Holden then had to see that, even more than ever, the very delicate relationship that this place in particular has with the wilderness around it.
And the answer to that, or an answer to that dilemma, is not kill the bear.
No.
Although sometimes that is the necessity.
And there's responsibility.
But in the long run, what I think the National Park Service has found out in the last however many years, is that the answer to that problem of the bear coming into camp and turning over to garbage can eating and becoming dependent on camp is not to put the food where the bear can get it.
No, but not to put up bleachers for people to watch the bears.
And not to put up bleachers for people to watch the bears, yeah. And not to give out bear food at the front door.
But to try to remain separate and at the same time a part of
it within one's own space without trying to dominate the bear.
I just wanted to say that, I've read about deep ecology, and I think that there is a fundamental problem in deep, if you're going to take the most extreme views on deep ecology and you're going to try to make that work with a Judeo-Christian understanding of Genesis and the story of creation. And I think that a lot of, we're hearing that problem here, and if you read about deep ecology, you hear it from the other side of the problem with religion and the Genesis sort of story of creation. And I think that what we can do here is get, there's a lot of, I think, really positive stuff that you can get from deep ecology about a new approach to creation and to your place in creation. And I think that maybe what we need to do is take a step back and not get so hung up on where it doesn't agree, because I don't think that you can understand and believe in the Genesis story of creation and completely agree with deep ecology, which, from what I've read, the deep ecologists will say that the bear and the person is equal and that you shouldn't necessarily, you know, kill the bear to save the person or whatever. And I think that that there is a lot of value in deep ecology, maybe just to meet somewhere in the middle as opposed to.
Well, let me just say, too, that I don't think that we hold, certainly don't hold the Duvall and Sessions view about deep ecology.
Yeah.
And there's a great variety. I think what we struggle with is this issue about how being deeply in relationship. I think the ethical thing I would fight, and I would hold very strongly, is this notion about opening ourselves to deeper relationship with all of creation. Now, how that's played out in terms of what our responsibilities are, how it's played out in terms of the Genesis story, as well as the story in Psalms and Romans, which are other, I think, somewhat different, offer some different kind of twists on the Genesis story that are, you know, still part of the canon. But I also think that we need to look at our tradition, too, and look at the wisdom that comes down to us. And again, it's not necessarily in conflict, but there are tensions there. I mean, there are more than one story in Scripture. And they're not all, you know, there's some tensions there. But it seems to me what we're struggling with is this idea about learning more to be in relationship with all of creation. And I think that's part of the praxis that's here. And I think part of that praxis is given that we're self-reflective beings. And again, one of the ethical stances here is that self-reflective beings, this transpersonal is like self-reflective beings have priority. That's one of the ethical stances. If you're a self-reflective being as a human being, or maybe a couple of other critters running around too, or are swimming around, you probably have, maybe you should have higher priority than the other folks. And so there's a lot of that that's looking people looking at too. So I think there's been a lot of evolution and a lot of critique of the deep ecology movement. Really, even the term, this person said we shouldn't even use that term, because what this person argues is that, if I could summarize it succinctly, is that what is the issue isn't shallow deep, but it's staying outside of or being embedded in. That's the real distinction. And once you make that distinction, being embedded in, then you can come down all different kind of places. Some places are going to be more difficult to fit into a scriptural perspective. Some are going to be much more congruent. But I think
what's kind of fascinating about that is the whole idea that we've often had the image of God as being something that stands outside versus being embedded within, and that when you take that down through the system, that it transforms how you understand. I mean, if you understand God being within versus outside, then you start thinking about creation the same way. Mm-hmm. It's being much more intimate.
And again, I like to say that where we start from is some very profound experiences of experiencing the presence of God in creation, and then trying to put words around it. And so part of our struggle, and again, we're in transition, is to try to figure out, put words around that very profound, you know, and by almost use the word mystical experience. We have 4 or 5 more minutes. Some more questions or comments.
I'm responding to the bears coming into camp. there's the cuteness factor. The cuteness factor is we have societies to save baby seals because they're cute, but we don't have societies to save cave dung beetles that are equally threatened that are not cute. this is true. And bears are cute. And bears are big, and we probably feel a lot more connection to bears than to other things. In fact, I think you made reference to seeing things through the eyes of a bear.
Bears are scary, too.
Yeah, they're scary. Within the first 5 minutes of cutting a hole, and I came off the bus, and I walked into the men's room there in the basement of the dining hall, and in the restroom, there was a decon, and it says on it, in green letters, kills mice. We can look at the bear and the mouse differently, or, as we're doing here, looking at the bear and the mouse the same. I think the cuteness factor comes in, and that the bear is big, it's more like us, and we preserve the bear, but the mouse, which is down there eating the lentils and eating the garbanzos and pooping in them, and, you know, it's disgusting, it's troublesome, deserves a decon. This says kills mice, but the well, somebody around here does. And I would give an answer. You know, you say there are no easy answers here. I think sometimes, you know, we become desperate enough that millennials are all being eaten and pooped in, and we have to feed the people, so put out the decon. This may engender some conversation here.
Yes, I just find it pretty interesting. Also, this comment about, you know, the mice versus the bears, it's like, as long as we're comfortable and we have our little world figured out, then we can fit everything else in around it, the bears or whatever. But it seems like ultimately we were chucked out of the garden. We're not going to have this complete understanding of how we fit into it, because we're making our way on our own. It's foggy, you know, and we're doing the best we can, and we're not going to let any other animal or the elements control us. We're not going to give it equal play, because we're going to want to work for our own comfort. And then when we get comfortable, we can sit back and reflect upon how we need to get back closer to it or something. It's kind of, it's pretty hypocritical in a way. I mean,
but that's the difficult struggle, and that's part of why it is so difficult. I mean, it's painful.
I mean, you go out in the mountains for 3 or 4 days and you're having a wonderful time, but it's pretty nice when you get home. I mean, because you wouldn't want to be out there all the time.
Let me turn this around and put it back in an urban setting. The church leaders of Chicago made the mistake of inviting my colleague and myself to come and talk about our work with the poor. And they couldn't even say the P word. So they said they wanted us to come and talk about being with the insecure. Okay? And our basic message to them was, we think we're called to be insecure by the gospel. In other words, we think we're called to be insecure because, to the extent that we're, and again, the contemplative reading of that too is, as soon as we have security, as soon as we think we have things figured out, we're separated, we're separating ourselves from God. As soon as we figure it out. And so, and Sharon Welch is a wonderful feminist theologian, has written a book called A Feminist Ethic of Risk that talks about kind of continuing to leap off of these cliffs together, to continue to take these risks. And that's what we're being called to. It's a very sharp edge, I think, to be called to continue to do this. But again, the rewards, as having glimpses of the realm. And so it's, again, the contemplative view isn't that you develop these rules that you have to do things, but by having certain kinds of experiences, you're compelled to have certain kinds of responsibilities, because that's just, you understand, that's the way God has organized the world. And I agree. This is the kind of default option. This is the way we fall back into a comfortable place. That's a very natural kind of human response, and it has a lot to do, I think, when we cut ourselves off from relationship with God's creation, that it's part of our sinfulness.
But would movements like recycling and things of this that have become so eminent in the way the earth has gotten with the population and the incredible use of resources, would these things even be the issues if the earth was, say, you know, 10 times bigger, or there were 10% fewer people, would we still, feel that it was necessary and ethically responsible to do those kinds of things? Or is it just that we've pushed ourselves to the brink that we have to do that? I mean,
I think it's
our parents and grandparents, certainly never thought like that.
Yes,
it's just the
whole world. Yes,
that's right, yeah.
Yes,
you have to. I mean, it's
would still be a spiritual issue. Mm-hmm. It would still be, if there were three of us on the planet, okay, if there were three of us on the planet, I think, and three human beings on the planet, and the three of us were not treating the planet with respect, we're cutting ourselves off from
all
God's creation.
We wouldn't worry about being grain-fed beef, though.
That's right, but that's another issue. Okay?
And it's not clear that when the population was smaller, we didn't worry about this. I mean, the evidence from people who have lived and worked with primal people is that they worry about it much more than we do.